You're listening to a special series of Between Two Flags for UNA Canada's Green Corps program. Through regular podcasts, Green Corps will invite a wide range of experts to discuss complex environmental, economic, and social issues. Live tweet as you listen with hashtag Between Two Flags.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the United Nations Association in Canada's Between Two Flags podcast. My name is Scott Bohatchik. I'm the director of Canada Green Corps, and today we are honored to be speaking with Omar Dominguez from the Happy City Project. The Happy City Project is a consulting firm that emerged after the publication of the Happy City book. They are interested in exploring the design happiness connection and hold workshops and provide consulting services to businesses and employers in Canada and abroad. Today with Omar, we're going to be discussing the value of urban design and human ecology and many other aspects of the importance of these two concepts. Omar is the Director of Operations and Sustainability at the Happy City Project. He leads business planning processes and daily operations of Happy City's consulting practice. He also enables the development and delivery of cutting-edge, value-creating sustainability strategies across Happy City's portfolio of activities. Omar is also a sustainable investment issues professional. He has engaged corporate executives, standard-setting bodies, and regulators to find solutions to mitigate risks to investors, society, and the environment. He holds a degree on international business from the Technological Institute of Monterey and an MA in community development and social planning from the University of British Columbia. Omar, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. I'm really excited to be chatting with you today.
Yeah, and so are we. It's an incredibly important topic to Green Corps. Urban design, human ecology, and happy cities are integral to a sustainable future and the overall health of our populations. Maybe I'll get you to start off by just explaining, how did you get to where you are now? What was the initial interest through your academic studies and professional life in urban design?
Certainly. I did a master's degree in social planning at the University of British Columbia, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was actually quite focused on the way that investment issues and money generates change, and I wanted to use leverage capital to make a difference on sustainability, social justice issues. So I worked with several institutions in Canada that focus on sustainable investment issues. Some of them would be sustainability, Sustainalytics, which is a research firm and headquartered in Toronto, but it's all over the world. Mm. And then after that, I worked with Ethical Funds, which is the largest socially responsible investor mutual fund in Canada. And we engaged companies on their environmental and social risks and on behalf of investors in those funds. And Charles and I have known each other for a long time. And during that time, there was a lot of interest in his work. And I came on board to help transform Happy City from a book into a consulting group that could help translate the ideas from the book and give city builders tools to use the insight, the research that we uncovered through the book and afterwards to transform urban design and use happiness and well-being as a framework for enhancing and improving the lives of cities. So it's been a journey of a couple of 2.5 years, more or less, and we've been learning a lot in just being a business and working with that team. And 2.5 years, this is where we are.
Wow, really interesting. I have to say that I read Charles's book, The Happy City, I think in 2014, and it was incredible. I found it fresh. I found it quite insightful. The research was fascinating, to be honest. And my knowledge of human ecology had been very limited. I'd read quite a bit of James Howard Kunstler and Jane Jacobs in school, but Charles really, and I think because I was living in Vancouver at the time, and coming from Edmonton, I think, you know, the two contrasting cities, a lot of what he was writing really came to the forefront and was quite visible. Could you maybe I'll give you a little bit of a chance to explain a little bit more about the Happy City Project and some of maybe the more specific projects you have going on in Vancouver and possibly across Canada?
Sure. So Happy City, we help build healthier, happier neighborhoods and cities by focusing on the relationship between urban design and well-being. Mm. We use evidence from areas of psychology, neuroscience, public health, behavioral economics, and we use this evidence to drive urban innovations, not just in Canada, but around the world. Toolbox focuses on doing keynotes, workshops, we do participatory events, and we do direct consultation on master plans, architecture, urban design, and the planning of urban systems. And we also create our own experiments where we don't find evidence to some of the advice that we're giving our client to come up with additional evidence to help people get a visceral understanding of the relationship between urban design and well-being. Our clients include municipalities, health authorities, NGOs, and many developers. And we are particularly excited about the role that developers have to create change in cities. Mm-hmm. And many of the developers that we're working have already done all of their homework regarding sustainability. Mm-hmm. So they've done their changes regarding energy efficiency, water conservation, conventional work around health and safety. But they're also understanding that there is a connection between the design of the places that they build and the health and the well-being of people that inhabit these places. Sure. Similarly, health authorities and municipalities are understanding that there's a direct link between the design of cities and public health. So we've worked, for example, with clients in the UK. The biggest real estate developer in the UK, which was one of these cases that had already done a lot of work in terms of sustainability and were seen as leaders. Mm-hmm. They see this as the next step in the journey of sustainability. We've also worked with organizations like the World Health Organization, which is part of the UN, where they have healthy city programs. Yeah. And, you know, as the UN traditionally focus in this area of city health and things like sanitation, the prevention of disease and epidemics, and they also began to understand that design of cities affected things like obesity, diabetes, and mm-hmm. other mobility-related diseases. But also what they're beginning to understand is that the design of cities affect the way that people treat and regard each other mm-hmm. in ways that we don't often even realize. So we've been helping them understand how the design of infrastructure can either bring people together and cause us to be nicer and kinder with each other, or it can literally tear people apart. So we're really excited that there's a lot of interest since the book came out. There have been a lot of interest from around the world to adopt these ideas and implement them into actual built environments and in public policies.
Wow, that's really fascinating, actually. And you know, maybe I'll just throw out a few examples of my own personal experience, and just if you can maybe comment on some of the research that might be applicable to that you've found out. I grew up like many other Canadians in the suburbs. You know, it was a detached house, long drives essentially. You know, the closest place to go to the grocery store was probably about a 500 meters or a kilometer, or, you know, more than 500 meters away. And it's just car centric. It's completely dependent on the car. James Howard Kunstler, his book, The Geography of Nowhere, he has this one quote. He says, "There was nothing like it before in history, a machine that promised liberation from the daily bondage of place. And in a free country like the United States, with the unrestricted right to travel, a vast geographical territory to spread out into, and a national tradition of picking up and moving whenever life became intolerable, the automobile became as a blessing." And I, you know, that quote I don't think is directly related to the creation of suburbs, but certainly the dismantling of public transportation systems in the 50s and 60s contributed to the huge expansion of suburbs. And, you know, that experience in the suburbs and then living downtown Vancouver in a high rise, I know in the Happy City book, you know, Charles talks about the stress that people feel when they're actually leaving their apartments to go down the elevator and they know they're not going to know the person next to them and they have to spend a minute with them in this small little space. And, you know, my time in the high rise wasn't that much more enjoyable, and certainly the suburbs weren't. So I guess how I'm going to tie this together is moving to Ottawa with sort of the row housing, but really very little front yard, but a huge front porch where many of the neighbors will go and sit and have tea or a drink. And I've found that I know way more, far many more of my neighbors than I ever have in the suburbs or in the high rises. Could you maybe talk about that kind of built environment and how the, you know, the interactions among people and the ways they bump into each other and the way they interact just create a sense of happiness or even improve their health?
Certainly. Can I ask you if you talk a little bit more about the kind of place that you live in Ottawa now?
Sure. It's a detached house. It's a standalone house, two story. But every house on the block has a large front porch and essentially no backyard. Mm-hmm. The porch is almost pretty much on the sidewalk. So when people are walking by, you get a head nod or you get a hi, you get a wave, things like that.
A sweet spot in density and crowding, and I mean there's so many things to comment on. Sure. What you just you know share. We know that just basically as humans we have a need to move, and therefore for many other reasons it makes sense in the history of evolution of cities to move from cities where there was crowding and lack of sanitation to this promise that we had of green pastures and space and that the health that suburbs provided. But now in the more and more that we've moved to suburbs, the less that we can move. So it has gone against some of these basic needs that we have. We know that people who live in suburbs now, given our conditions of population growth, people that live there emit about 2 times more carbon emissions than people that live in inner core cities. We spend about 2 times more on housing and transportation costs combined. Also, when we spend so much time driving, it's worse for local businesses because people who walk will spend more on businesses, and that has an effect on GDP. Mm-hmm. And also regarding health, people who live in suburbs tend to be 10 pounds heavier than people who live in walkable neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, one of the most concerning things is that people that live in suburbs are on general less social. Suburbs are less social because you spend so much time commuting that you have less time to spend with family, with friends, volunteers, vote, to exercise. So that promise that we had to go to suburbs has been robbed from us because there were other thousands and millions of people sometimes seeking that same lifestyle. And the other opposite is also, you know, it has negative impacts on our well-being and our health. When we are forced into crowding, we we tend to retreat. So we really need to find what is the sweet spot, and density is important. Some of the neighborhoods, like the one that you live in, Ottawa, really offer so much more opportunity to control your interactions. The work that Jan Gehl did determined that there's something like 10 yards is the ideal space between the sidewalk and the frontage of your house, because that allows you to either be sociable or to keep private when you're having a glass of wine in your front yard during the summer. So so there's definitely more evidence that is coming up regarding what is the design of these kinds of places that allows us to connect or retreat, have control over our interactions.
Yeah, fascinating. It really is so interesting. And there's so many factors. Like you said, it's going to be hard to keep this to 45 minutes. I guess, you know, as far as the Happy City Project is concerned, what have been the most striking research results in terms of what people or which designs work best? Is it, you know, what have you found, and how do you construct those built environments? And are planners leading the way on that? Do they understand those connections clearly? What's been your results?
Well, some of the experiments that we have learned the most from are we have partnered with neuroscientists, for example, at the Guggenheim to study what are the effects of people as we walk through cities. And what we found is that people report being much happier in active street edges. So if you take and compare a modern glass facade of a new building, and you compare it to a messy, jumbled up old tenement block with lots of activity, bars and restaurants, people report being much happier in the places where there are lots of activity, lots of opportunities and things to see and do, than in this more sterile blank edges. And a lot of that has to do with velocity of speed. Yeah. When we can slow down, we tend to be kinder and nicer with each other. So when we did that experiment, we also were curious to find out the extent to which these different kind of environments made people kinder, nicer with each other. So we also did an experiment with an NGO in Seattle, where we wanted to see the impact on sociability of these kinds of places. We put a whole bunch of volunteers and would send them out to sidewalks, and we wanted to measure how they were posing as pretending to be lost tourists. Just imagine them looking at their map, looking completely helpless. And we just wanted to see in which kind of places people were more helpful. So we found, again, that in this active street edges, people were four times more likely to stop and help them, offer help, to sometimes offer to lend them their cell phones, and sometimes even walk them to their destination. Wow. And through some anecdotal evidence, they're more likely to be asked on a date on those kinds of environments. So if you want to be more social, you may want to hang out in places that are more active.
More active street edges. That's really fascinating. It really is. I guess one of my earlier interests in urban design and social justice really was the previous mayor of Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa. I'm sure you're familiar with him. And his TED Talks were really great. And the way he was trying to transform the city, I have a quote from him. I'll just read this quickly. He says, "In Bogota, our goal was to make a city for all the children. And the measure of a good city is one where a child on a tricycle or bicycle can safely go anywhere. If a city is good for children, it will be good for everybody else. Over the last 80 years, we have been making cities much more for cars' mobility than for children's happiness. And he goes on to say, and this is a separate quote, but one that I've never forgotten. He says, a bikeway is a symbol that shows that a citizen on a $30 bicycle is equally important as a citizen in a $30,000 car. And I thought that was really, really quite powerful. And, you know, the opposition, I mean, I guess as a cyclist and, you know, the opposition to bike lanes in some cities, maybe that struck a nerve with me. But what are your thoughts on that, on transportation and making it accessible for all citizens?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the example of Peñalosa, and we've learned through how brave he was in terms of taking space away in places where maybe 20% of people own vehicles and they may have access to 80% of their public infrastructure.
Right.
So, and to make those kinds of investments where it costs so much more to invest in the widening of roads and additional freeways that it does to invest in public infrastructure, public transit. It just really is a question of equity, but we know that when we do those kinds of investments, it also it creates benefits to everyone. I also, for example, I visited Medellin a couple of years ago when I did some work with PAHO, the World Health Organization in the Americas, and I was really fascinated and inspired to see how a place that was was one of the worst cities in the world, most dangerous through so much violence, did just really important investments in public infrastructure and how that changed the lives of thousands of people. Experience that I had that just really touched me is I had a conversation with a kid in, I think the town is Santo Domingo, which was Pablo Escobar's neighborhood. And this was a place where you couldn't go out on the street after school. So by 5 o'clock, people had to be in their homes or you'd be gunned down.
Right.
So this kid approached me, obviously a tourist, like many tourists in this place now, where the city has made investments in the cable cars. So Medellin has this, you know, this. They started with a subway that goes down alongside the river. Medellin is a valley. And on the mountainsides, very hilly mountainsides, when it used to take people hours to zigzag all the way down to get to the bottom of the valley to take the subway or transportation, now in 15, 20 minutes, they can take this beautiful cable car and go down to their jobs. And these kinds of investments have really transformed these places. It's given people like my friend, this little kid that I met in this neighborhood, the fact that you don't need to be afraid anymore. And in our conversation, the city also invested something like $3 million in this really expensive library.
Right.
And so it's just giving people a sense that their lives matter, that there's equity. And when we want to test for social trust, one of the questions that we ask generally is if you drop your wallet on the street on your way home, what do you think are the chances that you would find it if a stranger you would get it back if a stranger finds it? And here's this 10-year-old kid, and you know, he thinks about it for a while, and I was saying, if your dad, for example, dropped his wallet in the cable car on his way home, do you think he would get it? So he thinks about it for a while, and he goes, well, yeah, he would get back, because people would pick it up, and then they would find him, and then he would get it back. To me, you know, that kind of change in a kid that was essentially afraid for his life to trusting everybody in the city is just an incredible example of the power that this kind of approach can do to change our lives, to change our future.
No, that's a great story, and yeah, that's really interesting as well. I've seen those cable cars. I've seen a few videos on them. They look great, and I think actually my friend went on one, and you know, they have several stops up the community, up the hill, up the valley, and you can get off whenever, and certainly much faster, much safer. And you know, I'm sure they're measuring the effects on air quality as well and other public health measures. I mean, as we know, I mean, car ownership is increasing at an alarming rate around the world. I mean, and I think the auto, you know, the personal automobile or that model of transport, even though, you know, we know the electrification of transport is incredibly important for reducing carbon emissions through transport and the investment in public infrastructure and public transport. I would like to ask a question, try to lead into Amanda's question. She's working with Vancouver Aquarium, actually, so you know, she's right next to you as well. And she says, she's speaking about urban sprawl and says that you know, urban sprawl impacts the local environment in a number of negative ways and perpetuates car culture. What are some of the ways that we can revise new urban design so that these negative environmental impacts are mitigated for future city development? And I guess, you know, my follow-up question is just how do we, I mean, and I'll just use Edmonton. I don't want to stick on Edmonton too much, but whenever I go back, I see a whole new subdivision on the outskirts of the city, and it just seems that urban sprawl is not really, it's just not decreasing, it's not stopping. And even though they are redeveloping the downtown center, about Amanda's point with urban sprawl, what are your thoughts? Where's the momentum going?
Well, I think there's so much inertia in the way that we that we make decisions, and part of the growth of cities, I mean, there are many reasons why suburbs continue to grow, and some of them, for example, in the case of U.S., have to do with the way that municipalities get additional revenue, that the policies encourage the growth at the fringe of cities, because municipalities are getting tax revenue that way. So there's not so much understanding of the way in which redeveloping city cores actually generates more tax revenue. Sure. Than it does for growth at the edge of the city. So, for example, if you were, we collaborate with folks in Asheville, mm-hmm. Urban 3, John Minikazi, does fascinating work on tax density, and he has studied the way that if you make a decision to allow a Walmart to establish itself at the edge of the city, mm-hmm. The impact on the municipality is that it's losing money, it's bleeding money. They do these really powerful visualizations of tax collection. Yeah. So growth at the edge of the city is actually bleeding money, because you need to service roads, you need to service schools, fire, mm-hmm. hospitals, etc. And if you instead made a decision to do an infill development in your city core, that shoots up in terms of if you have, you know, a mixed use housing and commercial space, some office space, that generates more jobs per acre. Yeah. It generates more tax per acre, and to change that, it just, first, we need that kind of awareness. When Joe goes around and does his presentations with, he's explaining people that there's no actual mechanism to make this kind of analysis that is mandated to see what that kind of growth is going to do to local finances. People's faces are just like, their jaws are dropping when they're seeing that, right, the decisions that they're making are actually affecting the future in the long term. So first we need to realize that, and then we also need to give people options that the truth is that the message of sustainability sometimes is difficult for a lot of people, where we say we have to fly less, we have to drive less, we have to consume less, and it can be a difficult message. But if instead we transform the message to through making sustainable choices, people are getting more of what really matters for life. You get more time to spend with your family, your friends. You'll get more a connection with people in your life. You'll get a more comfortable environment to live in, the kinds of places where people live in suburbs. We often, for our entertainment, may drive to more dense areas to go shopping, to go to schools, to go to parks and to work. So if we just adjust our expectations and our understanding of things that we think make us happy, the truth is that we make often fairly poor choices as to what are the things that are going to yield long-term happiness, then we'll be able to make better decisions. And the challenge is that we have evolutionary strikes against us in why we make these kinds of decisions. We have policy that has entrenched this kind of growth, and we just have to go against our nature in some ways, and we have to make brave new decisions. And the exciting thing is that everybody can start to realize that for themselves, and then that can help drive change in our policies and our institutions.
Interesting. And I mean, I guess I would like to hear your opinion about, you know, the positives and negatives of living in Vancouver compared to possibly other Canadian cities. And I think Vancouver benefits from, you know, having the mountains and ocean limiting that sprawl. Of course, we know the real estate market in Vancouver is an anomaly in Canada, I guess, maybe not compared to Montreal. But where do you see, what are your shining examples of cities around the world that are really leading the way, and not only leading the way in urban design and its connection to its citizens, but also in the lead against climate change, where, you know, a central focus of GreenCorp is the decarbonization of the economy and trying to reach our commitments in Paris at COP21. Are there some examples around the world or even in Vancouver that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many exciting things that are happening, and just the sense of urgency as to how fast we can change. I was mentioning Medellin, which is a really interesting, inspiring example. I am originally from Mexico City, and Medellin is also seen as a place that transformed from a very violent, very polluted kind of place to a place where life is different now. There are hope for the future, and they did, in addition to dealing with the problems of the drug cartels, they did all of these investments in public infrastructure, the subway, the cable cars, the public space, and it's just given, it's switched that priority from less people that have car ownership to the majority of people who use public transit, for example. So that has generated many changes and this sense of public trust. Sure. Cities like Copenhagen as well, who Copenhagen wasn't, their use of bicycles has been for many years different to many other cities like in North America. But also the sociability aspect of Copenhagen is something that wasn't part of their culture necessarily. So when they start closing streets, when they start leveraging some of the knowledge of people like Jane Gale were highlighting, then, and they give the streets and place to people, then it really changes the dynamic. It changes the health outcomes even, and many other places. I mean, what we see happening in large cities, like the changes in New York, people like Mexico City, because of their huge scale, any changes that they can do regarding climate change adaptation, because of the scale, can have really significant impacts in their GHG emissions, for example. There's a lot of work to do, and part of what we want is to be able to provide these examples. And I mean, our dreams is to scale the ability to bring people more into this conversation and to develop tools so that people can apply them around the world.
No, it's really a noble cause and great work. How big is the team in Vancouver?
So we have about the equivalent of 5.5 full-time positions. Mm-hmm. There is Charles, who is here, and myself with full-time, and then we have a couple of other colleagues that work on part-time basis. We have a colleague that works out of Halifax, and another colleague that works in the UK. And then we also collaborate with other planning firms, and now we have an intern through Green Corps.
Yes.
That is helping us develop a new project.
That's really exciting, and really pleased to have you as a partner. I think, you know, once I knew the project was approved, I think Charles was in the top three of my list to contact immediately, because the book really did make an impact. I have to state that again.
I guess
on that note of your team and employment, Amanda had a follow-up question as well. She said, do you see sustainable city development as a future employment opportunity for youth? And I guess maybe I'll broaden it a little bit. You know, what possible career paths do you see? I mean, this is so multifaceted in many different professions, I think, you know. But if you were offering advice to someone recently graduated or maybe someone thinking about pursuing a university degree in something, what would you advise is the best way to gain experience and focus their time to pursue a career in urban design?
Mm-hmm. If you look at some of the careers of the future and opportunities that are coming out of our needs to change our societies, change our economies, urban planning is one of those fields where there are growing opportunities, and certainly for people who have this need to have a difference or make an impact on the world, it's certainly something really interesting to look into. When I did my master's in social planning at UBC, I was fascinated with the background of my classmates.
Sure.
There were people who were engineers, people who were economists, people from areas such as theater and film and geography, architecture.
Yeah.
So it's a really diverse field. The kinds of things that people were doing were related to environmental management, emergency preparedness, community development, dealing with things like, water sanitation, sidewalks. Who knew sidewalks were so important? They are.
Yeah, they are.
And so people who develop this very specific interests in a very broad area of thinking of how to combine public interests with the constraints and of, you know, the environment to create better ways of living in cities and in the planet in general. I think it's a really fascinating field to be a part of. In terms of advice that I would give to people wanting to enter this field, and just generally, I would really encourage people to understand that the reality of the workforce nowadays is that people, professional roles have really large workloads, and when you're asking for advice, when you're asking for opportunities, it really helps to not just think about the kind of experience or knowledge that you want to learn, but you may want to think about what you can contribute to people so that you learn through your contribution, but also make a difference in the people who would love to help and provide advice, but are limited in their ability to give time to many requests for these kinds of opportunities. So, for example, we have been constantly flooded with inquiries for internships, for advice, for conversations. And the reality is that we don't always have the opportunity to connect with all these people. We would love to develop those ways of participating and learning about our work. And it's not always possible. So it helps. It would help, for example, if as a young person, there are you know, programs like Green Corps, where you can take it upon yourself to bring solutions to an employer. If you can find funding, if you can make a difference, if you can contribute to their business, you're much more likely to find valuable opportunities. And it's just going to be good for your own professional development.
Sure. No, that's really sound advice, and I hope the listeners appreciate that. As a closing note, Omar, are there any other additional resources you can share, you would like to share with people interested in urban design? Any websites or blogs or videos or books that you know, personal favorites even?
Yeah, I mean, there are many resources out there. Strong Towns, there are podcasts that are helpful as you're, you know, on the bus or at the gym to listen to these kinds of podcasts. You know, YouTube, there are so many worthy videos. Project for Public Spaces is a great organization. People in the field, in areas of tactical urbanism, I think it's Mike Layton that is kind of one of the leading professionals in that field. Those are all really interesting areas to follow. We are now, through a partnership with the BC Housing Health Authority, we have been doing research to understand the way in which the design of multifamily housing can contribute to sociability. So here in Vancouver, we the Vancouver Foundation came out with research about 4 years ago where they found that, this is before the problems of affordability, but they found that one of the biggest concerns in people here in Vancouver was this prevailing sense of social disconnection. And then around the world, we know that there's kind of a health crisis, a public crisis around loneliness and disconnection. So we want to understand the way to which urban design can it help bring people together. Like you were saying, the design of elevators may not be all that comfortable, but there are things that we can do to the way that we live that will help us bring us closer together. So in about a couple of months, we're going to come up with specific guidelines to architects and developers and municipalities as to the ways in which they can design housing, multifamily housing, to promote sociability. So while we may not have the opportunity to connect directly, I would encourage you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and to keep on top of some of the research that is coming out from many other people in this field.
Okay. That's fantastic. Thanks so much, Omar, for taking the time. I know, as you said, you get a lot of requests for talks and for internships and things like this. So to take this time and speak to the Green Corps is really appreciated on behalf of the United Nations Association in Canada as well. And thank you to all our listeners out there. We'll be sharing this in a couple of days. Of course, it's not live, but and we have some exciting speakers as well lined up in the following weeks. Omar, there's always so much more to talk about. You know, in the future, we would love to have you back on the show if there's if a certain topic, or if just because it's really it's a huge topic. And I know we didn't even really scratch the surface in 45 minutes here, but really appreciate it. And thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure. And yeah, I'd be happy to chat again.
Okay, great.